Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Be Dratty. Be Dratty makes some of the finest golf clothing on the market, and they have a great special running right now. If you spend $100 on their website, bedratty.com, you'll get a free bonus mystery polo from the Dratty Vault. So this is a neat little promotion. You don't know what you're going to get. I think we're all stuck in our own styles and preferences, but you might get sent something that you wouldn't normally buy, and you put it on and your wife or your significant other might say, wow, I really like that. And it gets you out of your comfort zone. So check that out, bedratty.com. If you spend over $100, you'll get a free bonus polo. So that's a good deal. Today, our guest on the podcast needs little introduction. Curtis Strange won back-to-back U.S. Opens and 14 other PGA Tour events during his Hall of Fame career. We talk about his career, Bryson's new style of play, what he loved most about working the U.S. Open broadcast with Fox, and much more.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
I wanted to ask you, you had a lot of huge moments in your career, obviously your two U.S. Open wins, but I'm curious where the closing eagle to win the NCAA title as a freshman ranks in your kind of golf memories.
You know, it's a good question, and it's one that I always answer when you talk about fortunate enough to have some highlights. I put that in there because highlights just aren't professional highlights. Highlights are at each stage in your career, and that highlight propelled you or gave you confidence to go forward. And certainly that was huge for me personally as a freshman for Wake Forest, as their first NCAA golf championship, for my teammates, for my coach. You know, it was just huge. And then the shot itself, hitting a one iron to 8 or 10 feet and making the putt. I was just trying to two putt and it went in. But, you know, it's in my top, you know, three or four, to be honest with you, because it was one that, you know, what pops up in your memory back? That's one of them that does.
Yeah, I imagine you can probably vividly remember all the details of that one iron. And, you know, for younger listeners, this isn't your driving one iron. This is a butter knife.
This is one you could cook a fillet. You could cut a fillet with. Yes. Go to your next time you go. Well, I don't know if you could even find a one iron anymore. I don't know if a youngster went to see what a one iron McGregor, Spalding, Wilson one iron used to look like. Gosh, where would you go to look for something like that other than your granddaddy's garage? You know, I don't know. But, you know, the blades were smaller. They were all forged. They were, you had to hit them, you know, the closer to the hosel, the more solid. But we did it. I mean, it was something you didn't know any better. You know, quite frankly, the middle and short irons were when you hit it solid, there was, with the softer old Balata ball, it was like butter. It was so solid and so had such a sound, soft sound, and it flew so nicely. But things have changed in all aspects of that sound and feel and look than yesterday.
Yeah. Speaking of change, how being a young player on tour in the late 70s and 80s, how was that different than the young players today?
Oh, you know what? I'm first going to say in the course of this conversation, I never ever look at the youngsters today and say, gosh, it was better in my day. Or I never want to be the old jealous, you know, curmudgeon that was better in my day. I think that it's all pretty much the same. You're out there to, you know, as a youngster, you get on tour, and first of all, you're happy to be there. It was a dream. And now let's go forward from here. And you keep your nose to the grindstone. You work. You hit out balls and balls and balls every single day. You progress slowly. Sometimes you don't think you progress, but you do. And then you might, you know, back in the day it was a top 60. But anyway, you competitively keep grinding and trying to compete against the best there is. And so from that standpoint, it's all the same. You're trying to be the best you can be. You all have similar backgrounds in that, you know, you came up in the game, you progressed, you enjoyed winning, but you knew there was a lot of work. And more likely than not, you loved it more than the next guy. You competed harder. You worked harder than the next guy, and it showed. And so now you know if you work hard on tour that I should improve. Some do, some don't. I mean, there's a lot of variables here that to be successful on tour that you have to have. You know, you have to be an athletic type of individual. Now we've had our exceptions, but most cases you're a pretty good, damn good athlete. You have to be stubborn. You know, you have to have a work ethic. You know, all these things that you have to love to compete, and you have to be able to accept the failure on the stage and be able to get up the next day and look forward to going to the golf course again, and all those things. So my answer to your simple question is I think it's all pretty much the same. It's all competition at a young age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've talked to Jeff Ogilvie a couple times, and he obviously played in an era a little bit later than yours, but one with huge change with obviously TrackMan. And one thing he talked about was the idea of everybody used to be searching for something, and you'd get to the range on a weekly basis, and somebody would say, "Oh, I think I figured it out." And with the advent of TrackMan, it's not really a secret anymore. Everybody's got it figured out every day.
Well, you know, TrackMan gives you more knowledge, more detail of what's really happening, but you figured it out as a player. You knew what worked in a feel or what you thought was a movement on the backswing or downswing. You knew that feel. When I felt that, say, on the start of my downswing, I hit the ball better. So you tried to emulate that and repeat that. Now, that you can do that in a daily, in a particular day. And then when you go to bed, it never seems to be there the next morning.
Yeah.
So you have to try to find that the next morning. And it might be a little bit different feel. It might be, but you get it. You get what I'm saying is that we had our own TrackMan within our own feel. And you have to go back to the clubs and balls were different. So I think you could feel the impact a little bit better because a mishit just off center, you could feel it because the blades were had such a smaller sweet spot. They were so much smaller, and the balls were softer, so you could feel where they were on the face. And so you had your own TrackMan, and you kind of knew your own strengths and weaknesses. Hopefully you did in your swing, and you knew how to adjust. And it was all about adjusting, and those who could do that more better than others were more successful.
Did you through your career have like a certain feel that you were always trying to get? And when you were swinging and playing your best, you were getting that specific feel. And if so, what was it?
Yes, I did. Again, we were mostly all feel players. There were a few mechanical type players, but, again, this was before it got so mechanical. And teachers changed and became way too mechanical with young kids. And that's another story for another day. But, yeah, I had feels, but they changed throughout a career because your body changes throughout a career and your swing changes. So that in itself is an adjustment. not every daily adjustment, but it just, you know, from time to time. Early on, I was a big swinger, very upright, stronger grip, launched it for in the day. So the feel was more movement from the body, from the ground up, to create the speed that I wanted. I was reasonably accurate in those days doing that, and I didn't know it at the time, but I had a good swing. I mean, my swing was online, so, and I didn't know anything about that stuff when I was in college. I just launched it and it went straight. but as you get on tour, I try to change my swing to be more consistent. I wanted to be able to compete every day, even those days you didn't feel very well or something was out of sorts. I still wanted to be able to get it around the golf course. So I throttled back just a little bit. I tried to tighten up a little bit. And so your feels changed. So my feel in those days when I went through this change starting back in the early 80s was, you know, my grip got a little weaker. You know, I kind of held on almost like a block. And I guess it was somewhat of a block through impact. But with the weak grip, it never went left. And my key, looking back on it now, was that I never, ever worried about the ball going left. So I basically had eliminated one side of the golf course. And, you know, when I missed, it went to the right. And so I knew that. And therefore, I could drive it straight. I'd ironed it pretty well. But more than anything else, I eliminated one side of the golf course.
Yes, one of my favorite sayings, faders eat filet and hookers eat hamburger.
Well, you know, it's when you do hook, and I don't know the last guy that hit sweeping hooks or hooks. First of all, the clubs don't allow it. The balls really don't allow it, the spinning sideways. But, you know, when you in the day, if you hit a big draw, you know, the last guy I remember was, Jesus, what was his name back in Arnold's? Anyway, they used to hit draws because they released it and they wanted to get maximum distance. But if you hit it, if you released it perfectly, it drew. Okay. If you release it too much, it drew too much and the ball runs out. So you didn't want to do that. So the next swing, you hold on a little bit and it goes to the right. So now you got both sides of the golf course is going. And there was a guy that didn't eat filet. Okay. when he's going both ways, he's searching for that feel. And when it's on, it's good. But now think about that little soft hang on cut that first of all, it doesn't cut as much because of the angle of attack as a hook. It comes down softer and more than likely because you're hanging on, you never miss left. I mean, you might miss left once in a while. And a guy I think of in modern times is a Jordan Spieth. He has it kind of blocked through the ball, but he misses left once in a while. And I don't know why that, or he used to anyway. And I'm not picking on him, but just most of those guys that have a little weaker grip that hold on, don't miss left. And so therefore, you know, it's just, it's kind of easy to control, you know, it listens a little better than that hook, they say.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I grew up playing a draw and you're exactly right. And then one of the best things I did was I got my game to where I just never think about hitting the ball left and I hit a little fade. And my favorite thing is when you miss right and with a fade, it just sits immediately. You know, you hit that high right poof ball. And then if you hit the hard hook, as soon as it hits the ground, you got 15, it misses 15, 20 yards more left.
Oh, my gosh. You know, first of all, say you're hitting a 5-iron into a green and you hit a kind of a hard draw. It's going to run through the back left of the green every time, more than likely. If you hit it in the left center of the fairway, she's going to run right on out of that fairway every time. So that cut doesn't. And, you know, when I was playing my best golf in the 80s, I kind of hit a little straight ball, a little tiny cut. But the shot I hated with a passion was that kind of little heely cut fade, but you know the difference, it stayed in the fairway every time. And I won some tournaments with that horrible shot that I hated, but I could find it every time in the fairway.
Yeah, even though it's not your favorite shot, you find it. It might be 20 yards short, but you're playing from the fairway, and I mean, you don't make a lot of bogeys from the fairway.
Well, and there's a good comment which you made. It might be a little shorter, yes, but it is in the fairway. And remember, in our day, we didn't have anybody that, because of the equipment, you couldn't, you just didn't hit it farther than anybody else. I never felt like I couldn't compete against anybody because they hit it a little bit farther than I did, because nobody launched it 30 or 40 yards by you. The first guy that did that, that ever came on the scene, was John Daly. And those who, when I was coming up, those who were maybe big 6'6" launchers of the golf ball, you know, they weren't considered great players because they hit it so far and the ball spun so much, they didn't hit many fairways. And so that's how the game has changed.
A guy that would remind me of from your era, like Dan Pohl, would that be a guy that would fit that description?
You know, Dan Pohl was a better striker of the ball than his career ever showed because of what we were talking about. He kind of hit a little drop fade every time. He had a short swing, baseball swing. He was a baseball player, very, very fast hands, but kind of almost a little blocker, if I remember correctly now. And so he drove the ball pretty well. I don't know if Dan was a great putter or not. I don't remember. But Dan did a lot of TV when he stopped playing. But Dan Pohl, here's a stat for you, won the driving distance, and I think it was 1988. Don't hold me to these facts. 1988, he won the driving distance on tour, and his distance was like 287 or 288, and that was it. Mm-hmm. How about that change for distance?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, if you're 288, you're bottom of the tour now.
Bottom of the tour, and what Bryson averages, 350 last week, 70, 65 yards difference. That's all.
Because the shorter hitters in the 80s were 240, 250 compared to 280.
Yeah, well, I was pretty much the middle of the field, very average, maybe a smidgen below average, and I was like 255 or 256. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made my living with 4, 5, and 6 irons. I mean, seriously, you know, 440, 450 par 4 was a 4 or 5 iron. Maybe a 6 iron all day long. Golf courses like Firestone, Augusta was long in cases when it got cool in the spring. Pebble Beach wasn't long, but there were some courses out there. I mean, just there were certain golf courses. Muirfield Village in the spring when it was cool was a long golf course, and it was 4, 5, or 6 irons all day long. Every day.
Bryson, you hit on, obviously, unbelievable performance. You know, goes miss beyond the 350 drives was incredible putting.
You know what? He's been the talk of every golfer for the last really kind of couple, 2 or 3 weeks, and especially after this week. First of all, I think he's showing the world. Now, I'm a Titleist guy, okay? I'm a Titleist ball guy, and I've always been very careful on, you know, talking about the ball because they used to pay me. So you can't criticize the hand that feeds you. But the point of the fact is he's showing the world of golf that it's just not all about the golf ball and the driver. Now, it's a big part of it, trust me, a huge part of it, the majority part of it. But the part of the equation that has never gotten enough attention in this ball that goes so far is the ability of these kids and the speed that they create, okay, and the accuracy in which they hit it with the speed. I walked for Fox the last 4 years in the U.S. Open. I've seen it firsthand. I saw Dustin Johnson carry the 3-wood at Aaron Hills 340. 330 or something up the hill on the last hole with a 3-wood one day. I mean, it's incredible stuff. But when you see what Bryson has done, he's gone from, you know, a nice hitter, you know, a nice plenty of length, to putting on muscle, gaining speed. But more so than anything else, now I'm not a physicist, but it's the mass that he's moving. It's the 40 pounds that he's put on that I never knew about. But when you add mass and speed, the ball will go farther. It's not about flexibility more. It's not all about strength. It's about the mass and moving that mass and having the strength to support it. Now, somebody might prove me wrong in what I just said, but it looks like that's what it is to me. And plus, he's trying to hit it bloody hard every time, but he's driving it. I saw this morning he's hitting 63% of the fairways or something. That's good for a normal person. 70% was very accurate on tour. And so he's proven all these people wrong that said it was just about the golf ball and the driver. It's about the athleticism of these players and the speed in which they create. And I kind of marvel at him. I do. Okay, he's a little different. Well, we're all a little different, okay? We're all type A different egomaniacs and very we're egomaniacs on tour, and we're also the most insecure individuals on the planet with our golf swings. So if that isn't a contradiction, but he's kind of figured something out here. And don't think you might not have somebody else try the same thing in the next year or two or three, because it seems to work. My question, I have two questions with this. I'm rambling now, but I have two questions with Bryson. One, when you try to hit it so hard every time, how long will that last? Okay. Now all it has to last is 8 years, and then he'll be, you know, maybe a 25-time winner, 30-time winner and 5 majors. Who knows what's going to be, what the future holds for him. But, the other thing is, well, will his body hold up? Oh, I know, the short game. When you put on this mass and you change your body structure, do you change your feel? I don't know. I think your feel is born within you. It's bred within you. So it might change a smidgen, but some people will question that. Will it change his feel? I don't know the answer to that because my body never changed. But if it does, he'll have to contend with that. But you know, he's a smart enough guy. He'll take care of every stone will be unturned with Bryson. Trust me.
Yeah, I think you hit the accuracy is unbelievable. And I think, you know, one of the things that gets lost a little bit with the distance debate is that.
Well, with accuracy and with accuracy, I always thought now within control, but the harder you hit it, the straighter you should hit it with a driver because everything is straightening out. Okay. If you're in control, whenever you start to get manipulative and hit it 80% or 75%, that's when your body doesn't react. You're putting it in positions. But when you swing 90%, 95%, everything straightens out at impact. And if you have a good swing, a good grip, a swing that's on plane, it should go just as straight as it's ever going to go. And so, yeah, as long as he's in control of the swing, he should drive it as straight as he used to. The only difference is the farther the ball goes, you know, with physics, the more it can go offline just with just the sheer numbers of it. But he's really driving it pretty straight for as hard as he's hitting it.
Yeah. And to create that speed, you have to be pretty fundamentally sound.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. You can't do it with just upper body. You can't do it with just arms and hands. Everything's moving. You know, it starts from the ground up, the weight shift to the left, the lower body, the upper middle torso, you know, it's just, and he seems to be doing even that with himself. Remember, he's a golf machine guy. He's a very, very mechanical guy in his swing. And I personally didn't know a guy that I shouldn't speak for him because it could be wrong, but a golf machine theorist is very mechanical. So therefore you're thinking about position so much. So I always wondered if you could swing as hard as you wanted to think about positions, but he seems to be freewheeling it and not encumbered with positions right now, which is what he used to be.
Did you play much with Bobby Clampett, who's obviously a golf machine guy?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I played with him. You know, I didn't play with him a lot, but, you know, I was already established on tour when this can't-miss kid was winning all these amateur tournaments, and he was long. He wasn't big, but we knew he was long. And he played in a couple of tournaments as an amateur, being from the West Coast. And, you know, that was my introduction to the kind of the golf machine theory. I don't even know if it's a theory or not. I don't know what it is. But And so he comes out and everybody's kind of intrigued. What is this guy? You know, he's got this tremendous lag and impact. I also did some clinics and played with him a little bit when he started going bad. And what he did was, I think he overdid the golf machine, but I don't know for a fact. But yeah, I knew and saw Bobby come up and then fall off the face of the earth.
It seemed like that Open where he was leading by, you know, I can't remember how much, but through two rounds was, and then he kind of blew it coming down the straight. It might have been Sandy Lyles when, I can't remember who won that year, but that really had a lasting impact on him.
Well, you know what, it really shouldn't have, because we all lose big tournaments throughout our career, especially when we're inexperienced. The pressure in a major championship is so amplified over a regular tour event, and a regular tour event is plenty. I mean, you couldn't spit if you had a gun to your head in a regular tour event when you're coming down the stretch and early on in your career, and then you throw yourself in a major. I might disagree with that it had a huge effect. If nothing else, you should have learned from it. Okay, you know, what did I do wrong? How can I improve? What did I learn from the pressure affecting my body, my swing speed, my thought process, all that stuff you take into account, many cases subconsciously. And so the next time you get in position, you learn from your mistakes prior. And so I disagree that it had a huge impact. Yeah, later on, you know, we all get disappointed, but you have to get back up the next day and go work.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think on every single level of golf that helps, even like your, you know, 8 handicap out at the club on weekends and loses a, you know, a net club championship, because the next year he's in that position, he's going to do better. Speaking of that, I you know, the 85 Masters is obviously one that in your career that kind of might have gotten away a little bit, but it's also one of the craziest stories, shooting 80 in the first round and then having a 2-shot lead on Sunday on the back nine at Augusta. Is that the tournament that you kind of think back to most and kind of long for a do-over? And also, how did that, you know, speaking about what you just talked about, how did that tournament have a positive impact on your career?
Well, that's when we just talked about Bobby Clampett and the Open Championship when he lost. That's, you know, I can speak from experience. Yes. You know, you're disappointed. I mean, you feel terrible for a while. And I knew the best thing I could do, and people told me that, is get your ass up, get back on the golf course as soon as you can, and get in contention. Now, we all want to get in contention, but get in contention as soon as you can and learn from it. Just kind of get up and go. And I did. I mean, that's the way I am. But yeah, 85, we just had our second baby and Sarah wasn't there. And, so I was there with a couple of friends and so shot 80 the first round, had, you know, was disappointed because I was playing well. I'd already won once or twice that year. But I'd made plane reservations to get home Friday late and, you know, be with our second son, who had just arrived. But I shot 65 the next day and jumped back in contention. The scores weren't real low that year, so I jumped right back, kind of not in to make the cut or anything, but kind of got back in contention. And then I shot 68th on Saturday. And I know all these details. But anyway, I'm still behind Raymond Floyd, but I'm in the last group. And next thing I know, I'm on the 10th tee with a 4-shot lead. And so, but the pressure, I'd never felt anything like that. I knew how to play golf. You'd play golf. You've been successful throughout, you know, the different stages of your career. And so I knew what to do. You breathe, number one. People say, what do you mean breathe? You breathe, number one. You make sure you breathe in deeply and out deeply. And just kind of take your time. And, you know, I didn't play terribly on the backside, but I lost. And give a lot of credit to Bernhard Langer, who won. But it was hard. It was hard, and it is the one I think about that got away. I was very fortunate that many didn't get away from me, and I don't say that. I didn't get all that many chances to win, but I felt like I took advantage when I had a chance to win. But that is the one that I think about. And as much as we all dearly love the Masters and Augusta National, it would have been great to go back there forever and put on a green jacket. But hey, it all works out in the end. And I can't dwell on it too much because we all lose a whole lot more than we win on tour. And that's why you have to be somewhat tough mentally, because the golf beats you up. The competition beats you up. You're playing against the best of the world every day. And you have to prove yourself every single day. You're only, you know, this is harsh, but I feel like I'm only as good as my last shot or my last round. And so I did beat myself up a lot. But the Masters was one that was the one that I wish I had maybe a do-over or two.
We talked just before about how much the game's changed from a distance standpoint. I read a old SI article about that round, and you were hitting a 4-wood on 13 from a hanging lie from 210. And you think about, you know, 13 today, like what Bryson might do this year is obviously everybody's talking about. He might be hitting a lob wedge in.
Well, I hit a good drive too. You know, I got up there and you talk about earlier, not worrying about the ball going left. You know, I had to hit it at this three in the day, those three pine trees out there in the other side of the fairway. And I couldn't even drive it through the fairway. Okay. On my line, I couldn't drive it through the fairway. Now you're up in the pine straw a lot, but, and I hit a really good drive. I hit it at that middle pine and she hits the fairway and jumps a little bit to the left. And I think I had 208 or 218, something like that. It was a perfect 4-wood off the hanging lie, and it would carry plenty over the creek. And I just hung it a little bit. And people that have never been there don't understand the slope in that fairway. These guys make it look easy, but it really isn't. And it's why you get out there and practice. But I hung it to the right. And so the one shot I wish I had the second shot there back and the second shot at 15, of course. But the third shot out of the water at 13 is one that was such a simple shot. Just hit it like a semi-buried bunker shot. And I didn't hit it hard enough. And it didn't get out, and I end up making bogey. But that's one I would like to have back, because that was just a simple shot that we all have hit over the years, and not a lot, but you know how to hit it. So that's one of three or four or five or six that I'd want back on the back. But you know, you learn. I you know, would I have won two U.S. Opens if I'd have won there? Who the hell knows? But I go back there, you know, still work for ESPN there every year, and I don't think about it often, but when you go back to Augusta every year, it seems to come up, and it seems to come up, and in a good way. But it would have been a wonderful story to shoot 80 and win. I don't give a rat's ass if I shoot 80 and win or not. I just want to win.
Yeah.
So, but it was one of those times. Yep.
It would have been incredible. It's that hanging lie. It's funny. I was playing last week with a buddy who plays on tour, and I had a hanging lie. It's very similar to that one you might see at 13 on a par 5. And I was trying to hit a 3-iron. It came out low. It didn't carry over this bunker that I had to carry over. And I turned to him. I go, how do you hit that thing high? And he goes, you know, Andy, you got to play a lot more golf than you play to hit that high.
Well, you know what? Yeah, and you know, strength and be able to do it. And trust me, sometimes it just won't come out high.
Yeah.
It's going to come in hot. It's going to come in hot and low, and you got to account for that. But you know, that's the beauty of Augusta. I don't think you get a level lie on the entire golf course, and that's the part of it that the camera angles and the camera, which flattens the 2D camera, flattens everything. And it's just hard to describe the little nuances around Augusta National that make it tough.
Do you think that those uneven lies, especially today with power, do you feel that uneven lies, throwing kind of score to par out the window, because I don't think that really matters anymore. It's a completely different game than when all these pars were established. Do do you feel like level lies is probably the best way to test the best players in the game now?
It certainly throws up, you know, a kink in your everyday just kind of flat Florida course. Yeah. excuse me. It's just one of the things that as a professional, you learn to adjust every shot and deal with it. Wind, not so much rain, but wind, hard conditions, unlevel lies, a lot of rough, all these things are elements that make the game tough. That's why the U.S. Open and maybe sometimes the Open Championship are the toughest test, because there is a lot of rock, a lot of rough, and accuracy is a priority. And if you don't, if you make mistakes, your mistakes are magnified. It's a game played outdoors. And sometimes if it's like it looked like this past week with Bryson, I mean, it looked like it was a game played in a dome. It looked like there was no wind. The weather was perfect. It was hot. The ball goes. All the above makes it easy. But hitting it 350 off the tee makes it so much easier. And so now you go compare Bryson, if he could average 330, 340, 350 at Augusta. Augusta being a second-shot golf course, okay? Very, very little rough. Wider corridors than any other golf course. So it's a second shot golf course with the undulating greens that they have, and they're so hard and fast. So now he's coming in with such a shorter club than the average guy. It just makes the game easier at Augusta National. You know, if he's coming in with a 9-iron and I'm back there hitting a 5-iron, guess who's going to win? Bryson, every time. And the putting is so different. I tweeted out yesterday, if I was Bryson, when I got to Augusta this year, I would, knowing what I know now at 65 years old, I would hit a few balls, not play 18 or play 9 holes, whatever they do, but I would spend twice as much time, half my time, twice as much time as I normally do on the putting green to get used to the speed, to feel really comfortable Thursday morning, ready to play. I never felt really comfortable at Augusta until maybe Friday afternoon or Saturday, because now you got 4 or 5 days under your belt and you're getting used to the speed. But that's how fast they were in the day compared to other greens. Now there's a lot of greens fast, but they're still the fastest. Augusta are still the fastest with the most undulation. So therefore there's putts out there that are so much faster than you've seen all year long. And they're actually frightening at times. You wonder, sometimes you look at a putt and you say, how in the hell, when is this ball going to stop? And it does, but I would get out there, if I was Bryson, spend a lot of time on that putting green, putting swooping putts, downhill putts, so he's comfortable, because if he makes a few putts and he drives it well, it's going to be tough to beat.
Yeah, I think you just hit on that. One of the things that makes it so tough is that fear factor. It's just like the golf swing you alluded to earlier, where when you go 80% instead of 95, you, all of a sudden your body doesn't react. And I feel like getting defensive on the greens is one of the worst things that can happen to your putting in a tournament setting, especially.
Boy, great point there. You do, and that brought up another thought. I putted a lot of putts at Augusta so defensively, just because of speed, and therefore your stroke even changes. You take it back slower, you go through slower, and now you're manipulating the putter, and you don't putt by feel, and therefore you don't putt as well. I'm telling you, some of them you looked at and you say, wow, and then you don't show that nobody can sense that. But you just go, my, wow, where is this ball going to stop?
Yeah.
One of the great stories, Seve four putts from about 4 feet at 16 one year, and he goes to the press room. Hey, Seve, how did your four putt 16? I miss, I make. In other words, enough of these silly questions,
speaking of Seve, so you had some Ryder Cup matches with Seve, and I read that there's a little bit of gamesmanship from Seve. Talk about Seve in the Ryder Cup. He kind of was a foil to Americans. And I'd love to hear a little bit about the gamesmanship and some of the things he would do to get under people's skin.
Well, you're exactly right. And that was just Sebi. You couldn't take it personally, but I did. What always pissed me off about Sebi, and it's nothing personal. I like the guy. He was such a competitor, and he was the backbone of the entire Ryder Cup, not resurgence, but surgence up in Europe. He was their leader. But he thrived on some of the gamesmanship that you might think that happens in match play, and it does. What pissed me off so much is that I knew that he had gotten to me, and I knew it was coming, and I still let it affect me. And so that's a problem with me. It's not a problem with him, but it's a problem with me. And that's the way he thrived on it. And he knew when he'd gotten to you. And I got to applaud him for doing that. That's, you knew he was coming with it, and he got to you. And so I say that with a big grin on my face because, gosh, we miss him. And what a charismatic guy he was, and what a great player. Unfortunately, he lost his game, and I never could understand why he didn't drive it or hit it any straighter, because he had a good swing. Great grip. Swing, it looked like it was on line the whole way, but in the later years, he didn't hit it very straight. But anyway, he was such a force in the Ryder Cup, and, I'm asked all the time, when did Europe become a force? Why did they become a force? And I'll tell you why they became a force. Sebi, Nick Faldo, Ian Woosnam, Bernhard Langer, Sandy, Nick, Sebi, Ian, and Bernhard. Five of the top 10, 12, 15 in the world. It's a pretty good nucleus to have when you're a Ryder Cup team.
Yeah, when you were playing your best golf, most of the top-end players, you were kind of the only American that was challenging that European crop for a couple years.
Yeah, I don't know why that was. I mean, we had Greg and Sebi, and then that crop of European players, and then, Tom Watson was still playing, really, really well and winning tournaments, and Hale Irwin, and a lot of younger players. I mean, I guess the U.S. Opens thrust me in front, but I didn't ever feel that way. I always felt I was just one of many. I never thought of myself as better than those guys. They were, look at Tom Watson and his, tremendous career. I never did that. I just, that wasn't the way I believe. Like I said, you're trying to prove yourself every day, and that's what I tried to do.
With Sebi in Ryder Cups, was that style that where he was never seemingly in the fairway, and was that part of the frustration of playing against him?
No, I never sensed that at all. I played with him numerous other times in major tournaments, and I didn't pay any attention to anybody else playing with, nor did I play against anybody. I'm out there doing the best I can. You learn that early on, is that you're playing against some people you feel like you should beat. You're playing against some of the guys that you admire and greatly admire for their long career. But I didn't care who I was playing with. Certainly the better competition, the bigger name, inspired you to do well, but I didn't ever look at anybody's swing. I was into myself. I was into my game and just doing what I thought I knew how to do.
I wanted to ask you about the 18-hole playoff at one of your U.S. Open wins with Faldo, and how that compared to, like, pressure-wise, that Monday 18-hole playoff versus a Sunday final round.
Magnified. And you're right. I mean, a Sunday final round head to head against a world-class player is not like a playoff, because there's other players that could come from behind and win. So in that respect, it was a little different, but you don't sleep the night before, you're anxious, you're on point, every shot you hit the next day is going to be magnified, but you don't dwell on that. you know, you try to do the best you can and you prepare the next morning. The longest time for any professional golfer is from the time he gets up to the time he tees off. And it's the most boring. It lasts forever. Say you get up at 8 o'clock on Monday morning for the playoff in the US Open, and you don't tee off till 2 or 2:30. It's an eternity. But once I get to the golf course and got to the practice tee, it was game on. That's now you're in your comfort zone. So you try to do the whole thing. You're anxious. I never got comfortable all day long. I really didn't, because you know that each shot, this next shot could win or lose your dream tournament. So you get to the first tee and I was nervous. But now you do what you know how to do. You go play golf. And I really chipped and putted well. It was a windy. We got up that day and it was breezier in Boston than ordinarily it would be in a hot summer day, June day. So I knew it was going to be harder. You know, it's a U.S. Open setup. Course is fast and firm. So there's going to be some missed greens. And I missed some greens, but I really chipped and putted well. And you know, we had a great day. And, you know, how many words were said? Zero between the two of us. And that's exactly the way I wanted it and the way it should have been. Two guys going head-to-head in what I think is the greatest championship in the world, and Nick thinks it's the second greatest championship in the world, and trying to win. And it was good competition.
Yeah. I mean, and then, so you win the next year also. And then Medina, you were in the hunt there for a three-peat. I read somewhere that it was really soft comparatively to, you know, your traditional U.S. Open setup.
Yeah, we got to Oak Hill that Monday, and it was hard and fast, and it was a tremendous amount of rough. It was the old style U.S. Open setup. Mm-hmm. Greens were hard and fast, a lot of sloping greens, not a lot of like Augusta National bumps and mounds and bruises, but just a lot of slope from back to front on a lot of the greens. So we're going, wow, this is really hard. This is really hard. Drives are running out of fairways into the rough. And then we got like 3 inches of rain on, it was Tuesday night, I think. Earlier in the week, Tuesday night, we got an enormous amount of rain and the whole setup changed. And from a player standpoint, you felt like now you could play more golf versus play so defensive and know you're going to get screwed a couple of times out there because of the firmness. And the whole thing changed. In my mind, it changed that now I'm going to be able to drive it in all the fairways and keep these longer irons on these greens easier than before. And it's exactly what happened. I didn't miss many fairways all week long. I really drove it well. The second round won me the golf term. I shot 64. So now I'm just hanging on, but it turned out well, but it did change overnight.
Yeah. In your mind, I guess, you know, there in that era, there are a lot of U.S. Open players where, you know, like a Scott Simpson seemingly was always in the hunt. You were a great U.S. Open player. Was there a certain style that really thrived in U.S. Opens? And do you feel like in covering the U.S. Open the last few years that it's changed a little bit?
Yeah, the style was you better put it in the fairway off the tee. Because remember, nobody dominated in length. And the rough was such back in the day that if you drove it in the rough, it was tough to get it anywhere near the green because we weren't strong. The ball didn't go. You couldn't overpower rough like that. So you most of the time couldn't get it to the green. So then you had to get it up and down. Now with the U.S. Open setups, it's so much different that I don't agree with, but a little bit wider fairways and a first cut that's 6, 8, 10 steps wider that you can play out of. And plus these players are bigger and stronger than we were. So the whole thing is easier, but that's another conversation for another day. But, it was, so you had to put it in the fairway and then there was always a lot of rough around the greens, and you had to put it on the green. It was tough to get it up and down from 3 or 4 inches of rough, you know, and you into a hard, fast green. So the whole thing was so different. And I'm not saying, you know, we have a lot of runoff areas now around U.S. Open golf courses, which if the golf course doesn't set up to that, why do that? And why, to me, have a runoff area when the rest of the golf course has rough around it? It's kind of manipulating the golf course where the architect, I didn't think, had that in mind. But that's, again, another story. But anyway, so priority was to put it in the fairway and put it on the green. And that's what you try to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the runoff areas are they have to obviously fit. It's an interesting debate whether obviously there's if your short game around the green and rough requires a certain type of skill, and then short grass around the green requires a different type, you know, different shots. It opens up way more shots and recovery options for players. But you could say that if the more skilled player might separate themselves even more from short grass.
You know, I will debate that with you. There's a lot of people that don't know how to hit it out of the rough, but it is a skill. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there luck involved? Well, there's luck involved in everything, but you're trying to penalize a poor second shot. And what I don't like is that, first of all, if it's just shot that's not exactly accurate, I don't like balls running away from the green 20 or. And that's not, you know, if the whole golf course is set up like that, like a Pinehurst, that's perfectly okay. But when you go around a golf course and all of a sudden the 14th hole is a perched up green, and now you have runoff everywhere, whereas the other 13, 14 holes, you have rough, then now you manipulate. You're changing the whole concept of the setup. And it's just my theory of setting up a golf course. But it's become in vogue. It's been around for a long time now. The Players' Championship has a lot of runoff area. But that's the way the golf course was originally set up. And they've gone back and forth a little bit on rough or runoff, but there's still a lot of runoff. When we go to Pebble Beach, and this past year, they didn't have but one or two runoffs, and that's okay. The prior U.S. Open, they had a lot of runoff, and that's not the way Pebble. Anyway, let's just be consistent is what I'm trying to say. And whatever's in vogue, I know it changes. But, you know, U.S. Open, to me, is supposed to be the hardest championship in our country because it's our national championship. It should test every bit of your skill and ability. And you should be exhausted on Monday morning after playing the U.S. Open. And that's the way I believe it should be.
Yeah, I agree with the consistency thing, because it looks stupid, too, when you have one runoff on 18 holes or two runoffs and you don't have them everywhere else.
And I was remiss by not mentioning Aaron Hills was all runoff as well. That was good. That was fun, you know. Aaron Hills was not a bad golf course. It was just we had perfect weather all week long, and that's why we shot those scores. But anyway, it's not a historical, traditional golf course, but it was a nice challenge for the guys.
Hey, I wanted to talk about 84. You finished third at Wingfoot, and you know, just behind Norman and Zeller. Curious, obviously it's a bummer that you're not going to be on the ground covering it for Fox this year, but tell us a little bit about Wingfoot as a U.S. Open venue.
Wingfoot's a hard golf course. In the day, and it still is, long, straightforward, traditional, no secrets, hard golf course. A lot of slope from back to front on a lot of greens. Deep bunker, deep bunkers. Hard to get it up and down. You have to be accurate. Greens aren't that big. It's just one of the great golf courses you'll ever play. And I must say, the greatest grill room, bar room in America. But anyway, You know, it's just when I played, when I finished third there in 84, that's some of the best golf I ever played in my life because it was so long. And if you drove it in the rough, you didn't have a chance to get it near the green. And I really, really played well. I went to the last 9 holes thinking I could get part of a playoff if I shot a couple under, and I just didn't putt very well. But anyway, you know, I wonder, it's a hard golf course. When I see 5, 6, 7 over par one in a U.S. Open, I think, why is it so hard? What have they done to it? And of course, you can always put hole locations where it's impossible to putt and make any putts. But I always think par is a good score. That means if par is shot in the U.S. Open, that means it's plenty hard. It's going to be and will be a great test this year, a great, great test. They've actually put a new tee in on the 10th hole, which is was 190 yards before, a great, great par three. Now it's like 230. So that'll be interesting to watch. But I'm hugely disappointed in not being able to go back to U.S. Open first time in many, many years. I was out of TV for 3 years from 50 to 53, and then ESPN called me and said, would you host the U.S. Open with Mike Tirico? Not call golf, but host. And I said, are you kidding me? Yes. To get back involved in golf TV. And that led to, you know, 65 years old doing the U.S. Open, and thought we were going to do it for 7 more years. And, you know, the transition from Fox to NBC, disappointed. We're all disappointed, but me especially, because I will miss going to the U.S. Open. It's a part of my life. It's a huge part of my family's life. And be able to call golf in a U.S. Open and be around the players and be around the officials and, you know, just be in that atmosphere. There's nothing like it. And, you know, some of my greatest moments were playing, yes, but I must say, being able to watch, being the last round with Brooks Koepka 2 years ago to win back-to-back was a great thrill for me to be there and see the next guy do it back-to-back and to watch some of the incredible shots that Gary Woodland hit last year. Incredible shots. The 3-wood on the 14th hole, the pitch off the green at 17. I mean, just incredible shots. Was really a thrill for me.
The start of that round was just incredible. How Woodland and Koepka were just going blow for blow those first 6 holes, birdie after birdie.
Yeah, you know, and don't think that for all the listeners and out there that don't think that I don't get fired up when I see that. I'm in the last group waiting in the first fairway for Gary Woodland to tee off. And I'm hearing on my headset that Koepka's just birdied, what, 2 of the first 3 or 3 of the first 4. And so now he's tied or something. And now he's really challenging Gary Woodland, who's never done this before. And Gary Woodland, they're both great guys. They're both, you know, you know, strong, fit, competitive individuals. And don't think that I don't get fired up and I'm on point and I'm want to do the best I can possibly do. And anything that comes out of my mouth, I want it to be concise and right on and exactly what the player is thinking. That's all my position out there that day, was to bring the viewer closer to what this guy is thinking and feeling and what's presented in front of him. And so I'm on point. And then the whole day was like that. And it was a thrill. I can't understate this. It was, or overstate this. It was such a thrill for me to be out there, be a part of something like that. And I'm going to miss it.
If you were talking to, say, a player and giving advice, what's some stuff that you picked up? Obviously, you were a great major championship player. What was some stuff that you picked up that you hadn't thought of while you were a player when you were doing you were announcing and part of the telecast watching golf that would you think would have helped you as a player?
You know what? I thought about that a lot. And there's one thing, but before I tell you, I want to say that I've heard a lot of announcers say that, you know, they learned from announcing more about playing and improve their game from announcing and that kind of stuff. That's a crock of shit. The only way you improve your game is to go out there and practice. and hit golf balls and play competitive golf. That's the only way you get better. But the one thing I did learn, that I didn't know when I was playing is that you don't have to be perfect to win. And I always felt like I had to be perfect to win. And therefore, I think I beat myself up a little bit too much. Maybe on the weekend or on Sunday when I didn't hit the perfect shot, I might have gotten down a little bit too much. And I never got really a defeatist attitude, but you know, things change. And when I have been in the booth for 23 years now and around the game and TV, that there's a lot of guys that miss hit shots and miss putts, but they take advantage of the opportunity when it presents itself and they're not perfect. And I always felt like I had to be perfect to win. And I would take a little different attitude to the backside on Sunday or maybe Sunday's round if I had to do it all over again. I'll tell you one other thing I learned over the years in a little bit different vein than your question was that I hit a lot of golf balls and I enjoyed practicing, but I felt like I had to beat balls to keep up with the Joneses, okay? If I had to do it all over again, I would hit half as many balls. Because nobody's ever won a tournament in the history of golf by striking the golf ball. You have to make putts and you have to chip well. So I would hit half as many balls because you're never going to get so good. That's a born trait, is to be able to hit the golf ball. You can improve a little bit from here to there, but where you can really improve is chipping and putting. Become the best chipper and putter you possibly can, and therefore that will take advantage of your ball striking. You win tournaments by your short game. You don't win them by driving in the fairway and striking the golf ball.
Yeah, I feel like what gets lost with statistics, and everybody always, you know, talks about how important driving and approach play is, but you know, those things get you into contention, and it's very rare. And you look at players over the histories of their careers, it's very rare. You know, almost all the people that you would tab an underachiever in terms of their win totals are great ball strikers who struggle around and on the greens, you know, and those, that's where you win tournaments, is like you said.
Bryson DeChambeau was number one in strokes gained last week driving, okay? That didn't win him the golf tournament. He was number one in putting. That won him the golf tournament. Certainly the driving helps, but the end game is getting into the hole. And whenever I ever won a golf tournament, and I didn't win many, because I remember a lot of them.
I mean, I think you're selling yourself a little short there.
Well, but when I won a tournament, yes, I played well, but I putted really, really well. Every single time, I really putted well. And something else, I always made a key putt coming down the stretch. You always have to hit a shot or make a putt coming down the stretch to win. Nobody ever lets it be easy for you, so you have to perform. But anyway, you know, you got to make putt. It's very simple.
What's that most, you know, you talked about hitting a shot down the stretch. Which shot in your mind is the most memorable one of all the shots?
Which qualifies what we were just talking about. The most important shot that I ever hit in my life was the bunker shot on the 72nd hole in the U.S. Open in 1988. Mm-hmm. To get in the playoff with Nick Faldo. If I don't hit that bunker shot and get it up and down, then I never have a chance to win. So that's the most important shot. The best shot might have been the one iron in the NCAA in 74. It might have been the four iron on the last hole over water to get in the playoff with Greg Norman in the Houston Open. It might have been there's three or four that you think about. And I qualify, not only were they good shots, they were late Sunday afternoon and they meant something when the pressure was on. I think about those type of shots. It makes you feel good when you do it, especially because this is what you strive to do it on the stage. And this doesn't start in professional golf. This starts back there when you're 9 and 10 years old.
you dream about the U.S. Open, you dream about the Masters. And so you dream about being on the last hole against Hogan, Snead, you know, Palmer, Nicklaus, whoever your heroes might be, and you compete against them in your own imagination. You're hitting three or four balls out there. And so when you finally get there, I've always felt like, you know, you better have the guts to fail, because you're going to fail a whole lot more than you succeed. But you got to, when you fail, you got to get back up. You can't go back in your hole and bury your head for the next 3 weeks. You know, you got to be able to get back up there and do it again. And some can do it and some can't. And I enjoyed the competition. I loved being in the last group or the late Sunday afternoon, because that's when you find out, did all of this work pay off? Have I succeeded in this game? Can I do this on this grandest stage? And if I can hit those shots, you know, on the last hole, Houston or the U.S. Open or wherever it might be, then you know what? I've done my work. This is all I can do.
Yeah, it's, I mean, golf, you hit on so many things there, but I think one of the, I qualified for a U.S. Mid-Am a few years ago, and one of my buddies who I play tournament golf with, we were talking after, and he said, you know, you really got to savor this moment, because this is the 1%. You know, 99% of the time, golf just kicks you in the nuts and says, you know, go try harder, play better next time. But that 1%, when you pull off the shot, or when you get it done down the stretch, is like the best feeling in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. To hit that 5 or 6 iron or whatever club it is, right flush, you finish in balance, the ball's going where you're looking, it means a lot. You know, it's just, there's nothing like it. And you don't have to hit many of them to keep you coming back. But let's not forget, this isn't about professional golf. This is about you qualifying for the Mid-Am, or my son qualified for the Mid-Am some 3 years ago. And it could be the USAM. It could be a college tournament. It could be, you could be, an older guy playing senior amateur golf, you know, maybe a senior amateur in the senior open.
It's not about just professional golf.
Yeah, club championship, absolutely. And so it's all these stages of golf that keeps bringing you back when you hit the good shot or you perform when it matters the most.
So I got a couple quick questions on the way out. Thank you so much for the time. But what's the scariest green at Wingfoot?
Let me think here for a minute. 9 is got a lot of undulation to it, meaning not so much back to front, but a lot of movement. 1 has a lot of slope from back to front. 3 has a tremendous amount of slope from back to front. You know, keeping it below the hole is going to be key there. Putting it in the fairway and keep it below the hole. It's pretty simple at Wingfoot. And again, at Wingfoot, being an old traditional golf course, everything's right in front of you. There's no hidden gems out there. It's right in front of you. It's just a tough test.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how if the power's nullified a little bit by the rough and the greens there, because those greens, if you're in the rough, can be so tough to get to really control the golf ball.
Oh, that's the key of the rough. Is that, yeah, you can get it as strong as these players are now. They can get it to the green, but you can't control where it's going to stop so much. And so therefore, with being a really tough course to get it up and in, now you'll be left with some very, very difficult up and ins. And that's the equalizer at Wingfoot.
Mm-hmm. And then I stumbled across a story about an old bullseye putter that you had that you kind of trashed after a buddy of yours,
This is college golf at its finest. So I got this old bullseye. My favorite putter still of all time is the bullseye flange putter, okay? You talk about butter feeling, soft feeling. And so we play a college tournament. I didn't putt well. I was ranting and raving on the 6-hour drive home or whatever. And Jay Haas, who was always on my ass, you know, nonstop. And he's telling me, you know, that putter is not very good for you. You don't, your style, your way you do, it's not very good for you. You should change putters, blah, blah, blah. And finally, I had enough. And I opened the window of the car running 80 miles an hour down the interstate and dragged this son of a bitch on the asphalt for about 3 miles and destroyed this wonderful putter. But I just destroyed it and then let it go and threw it away. And then all of a sudden I look back at Jay and he's laughing his ass off thinking, I was just kidding you. So that was one of the stories of some of the stuff that happens in college golf, which is some of the greatest 3 years of my life.
I wonder how many majors you would have gotten with that old putter.
You know, I got a couple I still have in my house that were exact copies of that. Of course, they all were a little bit different because they're all so hand ground back in the day. But those putters, I putted with them my whole life until I finally went to the Zing 2 back in about middle to late 80s, middle 80s. You know, when you look at these modern day putters, they're big and they're space balanced and they're solid, but they have big sweet spots. You talk about the old cash ins, the old bullseyes, the old this or that. You talk about small sweet spots, but when you putted well, there was no feeling like it.
Yeah. I think that's, everybody talks about, the driver and how forgiving it is and the ball. And I think one of the other big things is the putter just hitting, you know, even in 1995 putter versus today is so much harder to putt well with it, because if you miss it just a little, you're going to end up 10 feet short.
Oh, absolutely. But I think the putters and the clubs being bigger sweet spots, even professionals, we've gotten a little careless in our striking, in our putting. If you went back to the old equipment, you would adjust quickly, but you would adjust by being more exact, because you know you have to be exact. I went back to blade irons 3 or 4 years ago, Titleist blade irons, for that simple reason. I said, I came out of the womb playing blades. I'm going back in the grave playing blades, and because you have to be more exact, and I think it makes you play better, and just, I don't know. I like the look and the feel, and maybe I'm a little stubborn.
Yeah. I have an old Persimmon driver that sometimes when I'm struggling with the driver, I'll bring that out, and I have to focus so much on just hitting it solid that it just gets everything kind of back into place.
Exactly. And that's all I mean. Everything back into place. You concentrating on what you're doing and you hit it really well. You really do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Curtis, thanks so much for the time. We'll have to have you on again, maybe around a major, and really going to miss you not being on TV with Fox this year. And thanks again.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for those comments. And always enjoy talking about the game of golf. It's been a great life for me and a career. And I still think about it every day, even though I don't play much. I still think about it every day. So thanks for having me on.